Good morning. Swami, as you know, arrived yesterday, and we were all prepared with this wonderful little portable wheeling chair to, you know, get him off the plane and get him to the community and be able to usher him without him having to walk, because he's been having some trouble with his body, severe vertigo and other odd nausea and things that have been plaguing him lately. But he announced to us before he got off the plane that he wanted to get off the plane and go straight to Fry's, where he bought a new portable computer, which is all of our birthday gift to him. But David called last night, and he wanted each of you to know that Swami sends his love. And this will be a wonderful visit with him this summer, tremendous visit. As did I forget anything?
No.
Okay. He didn't even need the chair. He walked right, that's what I was going to say. He walked right from the car up the stairs into Asha and David's home, Chela Bhavan, so everything went well. There was a wonderful email that went out that probably many of you received from Miriam, his angelic and stalwart nurse that stays with him in through his life in India and wherever he goes. And she was describing this moment that was very beautiful. It was after a birthday dinner that the Italians had given Swami in Assisi. And during the dinner, he started not to feel well. He's been having this trouble with what's called Meniere's disease. And Asha's described this before to many of us. You just don't know which way is up. And he began to feel badly, and they began to escort him out to the car. And so people got up and began, you know, forming a line and wishing him well, sending him light as he was getting to the car. And what they were describing was that his neck was hung down like this, and his legs were just dangling from behind. He was being held up from underneath his arms. In the human sense, we look at something like that and it just tears our heart out. But there was this group of about 20 people, not everybody could see this, but of which Miriam was a part, and he turned his face and looked, and this look of bliss just emanated and infused everybody who could see it. Just once and for all, and over again, we realize, I am not this body, you are not this body, none of us are this existence. And it was just completely untouched by it all. It was very beautiful. And Asha was saying something important in the last Bhagavad Gita class last week that I think is worth saying again, is that in Swami's life right now, it's a celebration. Master has said he'll be free after this life. This is a time of celebration. He'll be, I can only talk about this intellectually, but I assume that means he'll be breaking the physical, the astral, the causal bonds. And if you go back and into the autobiography and read that just mind-blowing chapter, The Resurrection of Yukteswar, it's worth really reading again and again and trying to take that in, because that's not only where he will be going, but it's where we're going to. And that's what this beautiful writing is on today, the inner kingdom. It's describing this tree, and our sap, our life force, our energy is just wanting to move up this tree. And we just have these states of gravity of our higher thoughts and our lower thoughts, and which thoughts are going to win, to pull that energy up or to win it, to pull it down. And that's the battle that we fight as yogis of doing this day after day after day. And Swami's life is such a beautiful example of somebody who's fought that battle and won, and shows us what it's like to be beyond the physical, beyond the astral. In the chapter, The Resurrection of Yukteswar, Yukteswar comes to Yogananda after his death. He appears in his form as Yogananda knew him in his life. And at first, Yogananda just clings to him and just wouldn't let him go. And Yukteswar says, if you just let go your grasp a little bit, you know, I can begin to tell you something of where I've come from. But he describes our physical world as this little basket beneath this vast balloon of the astral world. This astral world that has all of these levels and gradations of consciousness, of illumination in it. People who are coming to learn lessons that are difficult in life after death. And people who come who are just ready to start forward and serving and loving God and going toward the light. Because in the astral form, that's what we are, is simply light. There is no speech. There is no written word. We just communicate by thought. So imagine how clean we want our thoughts to be when we go to the astral world, because there, you know, misunderstandings can happen like that. But in light of that, of just this, just the smallness of our physical world, we've read in the paper recently that 28 new planets have been discovered. You know, suddenly, 28 all at once. And in January, I guess, there was a new planet that looks very much like Earth, 25,000 light years away. I don't know if that's, you need warp drive to get there, but it looks very much like Earth. It's a water-bearing planet. And so we're just beginning, you know, we're out here on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, just way out on the edge. We don't even know who else is around, if there's anyone else around. And you can see that we're very much simply at the time that Galileo and Copernicus were. You know, are there really other people out there on other planets? Of course there are. There have to be. But we haven't met them yet. And now that's beginning possibly to happen. But still, as vast as our universe is, it's only a little basket beneath this luminous balloon of the astral world, which Yogananda says is billions of years older than the physical world. So here we are, living our lives, going through what we go through, and we're trying to remember who we are. And it seems like a lot of what I learn when I go through, you know, the tests that come to us to free us from our bonds of limitation, is that there's always a greater perspective to have. There's a greater perspective always. I was going through a very difficult trial recently. I had said something to a dear friend, and it was completely out of reaction. It was unthinking. It was just said, you know, off the top of my head. And I had to go through the experience of the pain of hurting someone else, and the pain of having that hurt me in response. And then the need to get deeper into myself to find out what was really going on there, so I can communicate that, so I can be true to what that was. Because inside every test, there's this treasure trove of truth that tells us that we're not that limited self-identity that we were reacting with that pain with. I mean, those are our ideas. God has given us this divine birthright. Our spines are this conduit to the divine itself. And everything is calling us. Every aspect that's already within ourselves is calling us to know that, to transcend the physical, to know the astral. Yogananda says it's simply meditating, finding peace, is to enter the astral world. And so I was going into myself to find out what was the lesson I was trying to learn here. And it was a beautiful sense of expansion that happened through that, because everything comes to just try to break us free from these self-limitations. And once I realized, oh my God, you know, I was only just thinking of my own puny little misguided perception. I wasn't even putting myself in the other person's shoes. That there's this great freedom that happened from experiencing that. And I think every test is worth it for the gems that we receive from them. Because I know certainly when I make the biggest, you know, bloopers, large and small, it teaches me compassion for myself, but compassion for others, because I can no longer judge them for making that same mistake that I make, you know? And our compassion increases, and it increases, and increases. And even in more and more difficult trials, we can begin to find that compassion. There was a book that came out recently by a woman who went through the Rwandan Holocaust called Left to Tell. It's an amazing book. I highly recommend it. But this is a woman who, this was in the early 90s in Rwanda. During a period of 2 weeks, 100 million people were killed. Were just, their neighbors rose up. It was just mass insanity through the country. One tribe rose to try to annihilate the other. And this woman belonged to the tribe that that was going to be annihilated. And she was able to escape and find refuge in a bathroom in a minister's home with 7 other women. A bathroom that held only a shower and a toilet. Very small little space. She had to stay in that space for 3 months. And the most fascinating experience, reading her experience, fascinating thing about reading her experience was that, you know, she felt the fear of this tremendous, you know, the most horrific of experiences, your own neighbors rising up with machetes to take your life. And neighbors that she knew and trusted and were friends, they're her friends. And they were coming to try to find her and these other women. And she could feel the hatred and the evil from their wrong thinking, from their own ignorance. It felt like an attack of a physical force on her body. She could feel these blows against her of this anger and the hatred coming toward her. And she had to go so deep in herself to find the courage, to find the strength to pray and to have faith that God would help her through this. And she just made this immediate connection. God, don't let me go. While others around her were just falling to pieces naturally. It was a horrific experience. But she said, God, don't let me go. Give me the strength. Give me the courage. And slowly she felt that peace seeping into her in the bathroom with these bodies all piled on top of each other, trying to breathe and feel and be comfortable. And then after a while, that connection began to deepen, and then she began to ask, and give me forgiveness for what they're doing. And it's the most beautiful example when we read stories like this, because, you know, I don't know about you, but I feel like a test has got to be like an earthquake or, you know, something big that you can get your hands around. But oftentimes tests just wheedle in there, you know, in places where you just don't want to have to go in yourself. Just too humiliating, too uncomfortable. You know, we kind of can tend to think that life is too inconveniently arranged, you know, for our unfoldment. But that's ours. That stuff that we have to make through and negotiate through every day is what helps us find the truth and the compassion. And that place in us that is the deepest is the place where God is. Just simply the place where God is in the deepest sense in our heart. And that's what this woman had to do. She had to find forgiveness. And in this aspect of the tree, that how we, you know, we're combating duality all the time. And it's almost like there's this jiggling force in our own bodies that we can feel sometimes. We're desperately trying to just stand still and be present. And when she brought in forgiveness, it brought that whole holocaust of energy and just horror into a center place deep within herself where everything was calm, where everything was just fine. And as it, you know, I won't tell the whole story because it's really wonderful to read, but you can imagine that toward the end of this experience, she looked fondly toward that time in the bathroom because that's the time when she was closest to God. So it's just, it's beautiful how God works with us, and we have to remember how Yogananda said to us, circumstances are neutral. It doesn't matter what we're going through, but we have to look at what we're learning. We have to try desperately to look into the other person's point of view and to try to understand from a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger perspective. We've got to break the physical realm. We've got to break the astral sheath. We've got to break the causal sheath, and I direct you to that chapter because I'm not going to go into this now. But It's really, truly an incredible journey that the yogi gets to make. And it's all right there. God doesn't want us to be in pride. God doesn't want us to suffer. God doesn't want us to be afraid. Those are all our mind-born little habits. God wants us to be free. God wants us to feel his joy and his bliss. And that's all that's ever going on at any moment. It's really a mind-blowing thought. But that's what Yukteswar was talking about in this chapter. You know, if you begin to wrap your mind around just even the astral world, let alone the causal realm, let alone what's beyond all that, our own guru came from beyond the three worlds. He came beyond where it was just one with God. Imagine a little speck of a soul illuminated perfectly with God came down through all those worlds to be with us so we could know ourselves, who we truly are. It's a magnificent thing. And as we just continue to take that in, there was also one image that came to mind recently. When I first stepped foot in an Ananda service 20 years ago in the office building of All Religions down on California Street above Kinko's, I came into what was then a Wednesday night purification ceremony, and I was remembering the person who I met that evening, who was Karuna. It was a wonderful Australian man. I mean, all I have to say is Australian man, and you know, automatically, you know, he's friendly, he was a great light, he was a great joy to be around. And I walked into this attunement ceremony. I hadn't even read the autobiography, I hadn't heard of Swami Kriyananda, and there was this, it was, the masters were in an ark on the wall, and they were praying to the masters, and I remember someone saying Sri Yukteswar, and I said, there's just no way I'm going to remember that name. You can't even say that name, forget it. I mean, right there, I thought, this is just mind-blowing. But what was so charming about that moment was how utterly natural everyone was that was there, especially Karuna. He was standing up on the stage doing the energization exercises that I, of course, never heard of. And I thought, what is this? This is great. I mean, that's just so kooky. You know, I love it. But it was the spirit of being perfectly natural, perfectly at home, in exactly where we are, and exactly what we're doing, and just enjoying the heck out of it. And Karuna, great soul that he is, died of cancer a few years back. But before he left, he knew he had a month, maybe left of his life. He arranged a lunch for here, because he had lived here for a while, and arranged a lunch of all those that he'd known. And we went to this Chinese restaurant. There was two big circular tables, you know, full of these friends of his. And of course, we're all feeling this kind of little knot in our heart, you know, because he's going to be going, and we're a little sad. And not Karuna. Karuna was just like running to the astral world. He was sitting at one table just charming everyone with great laughter and great stories. Everybody was laughing. Everybody was engaged. Didn't eat a bite. You know, he was using chemotherapy and all that stuff. He wasn't even hungry. And then he'd go to the next table and just charm everybody else. Isn't it great? And you just felt so wonderful after that. I mean, that's the mark of a great soul who can run the race to the end of life like that and greet it with open arms. I'm yours, God. I've always been yours. Take me.
The Ananda Dairy, and he came over to help me clean out the Ananda Dairy because after probably a year of cow manure and muck and straw and hay, he had quite a floor. It was built up, so we have to shovel it out, which is the joy of working in a dairy. And no, he came over to help me. He just arrived at the Ananda Village, and we had the great time. He would call me Cobb, which means friend, I think, in Australian. And we were digging away and digging away, but I forgot to tell him when you're digging out straw and manure and muck, what creates underneath all this layer is methane gas. And next thing I know, Karuna's digging and digging, and we're talking, having a great time, and I'm being very careful, but I forgot to tell him. So next thing I know, he's collapsed. He's over out against the side of the barn. This is his first day at Ananda working with me. So I grabbed him. He was kind of awake. I pulled him off, I got him outside, more away from the gas, and ever since that day, we were just completely tight friends. He lived the experience. I like to read about Yogananda's campaigns he went on through the 1920s and 30s. They're hard to find sometimes. There's not a lot of written in books about it, but sometimes you can find through old archives, newspaper archives, about him coming to particular cities. This one was in the 20s up in, he was visiting Seattle, and he visited the home of a woman by the name of Edith Evelyn. And Edith writes that he didn't really say very much, but he was quiet, and he may have visited her more, since he did go to Seattle quite a few times, but he commented that he was standing, looking out a window, or gazing, I think, across maybe the room, and he said somebody had an experience of God in this spot. And the spot was a steer on a steerwell. And I thought when I first read that, I believe in experiences of God, but on a steer, on a step up a steerwell, I couldn't quite grab it. He continues to say that wherever anybody has an experience of the divine, a cosmic consciousness of God, that vibration stays in that spot. It doesn't dissipate with the wind or get blown away. It's still there. That's why Yoganandaji said that in the LA Basin, which is all freeways and 10 million people, he said that many multiple thousands of years ago, there were great yogis living there in tune with the divine, which is why he made his headquarters in Los Angeles. And it's interesting, before I knew that, I haven't been to LA a lot, but when I'm down there, there is a real sense of joy there. I mean, underneath all the stuff that you see on the physical level, there's a real vibration of devotion you can feel. Now, those vibrations are just not in Seattle on a stairwell or in the LA Basin, but they're everywhere around this planet. And that's why pilgrimage, the external pilgrimages that people sometimes have a choice to take. I know many of you have been on pilgrimage. It's a very good thing to do. It was 20 years ago this year that I went to India for the first time, and it was just perfect, actually. Much different than looking out the window here and seeing the Bay Area landing in India. We traveled up to Kashmir, to Srinagar, we traveled to Nepal, we traveled down into Calcutta. We went to the places that Yogananda had been to, but I can remember each of those moments in each of those temples, and still when I meditate, experience what I felt in those temples 20 years later. It's a lasting vibration that's lasting in the soil of India, but also it lasts inside of you. I can remember in Kashmir going up 300 steps to get to one of the Shankara's temples in Kashmir, is that what it is? And getting up to this little temple on a hilltop. And I didn't have to go in. I did go in, but it was just vibrating with divinity. And you could, when you get close, walking up the steeper steps to this little temple, I mean, it's a little stupa, tiny. The big blocks of steps going up to this temple were grooved from the thousands of years people were walking up to this little temple. And I remember the priest, the Brahmin, the Rishi who was in that little temple doing the japa, praying for people, repeated himself over and over. It was just vibrating with divinity. And it wasn't as if, it changed my life. And that was just the beginning of the trip. If you sit in Yogananda's attic where he found God, if you travel to any of the places that Yogananda, to LA, has spent time, you feel maybe not the personality of Yogananda, but you feel a divine connection, and it's very real. And it's not so much real because it's physically real for you, which it is, it's real inside of you. It awakens inside of you, the inner pilgrimage. The external pilgrimages are excellent. They're fantastic to do just a few hours from here. Ananda Village, when you go on property where people have meditated for 40 years, where Swamiji has meditated and blessed and is part of Yogananda's mission, you get on the property and you're awake. I mean, it's gorgeous up there in the foothills, but you're you're alert. You're alert physically, but you're also alert inwardly. It's like your chakras just wake up and you feel like, let's sit down here and meditate. And that's just a few hours away. I mean, from India, after a three-week pilgrimage, I was completely in bliss on that long plane ride home. And we stopped in Assisi, Italy, and I walked into the first church, Santa Chiara. The big cross of St. Francis is right there. And I sat down in that church and immediately went right off into a deep, deep state. And Francis in Assisi, Yogananda said that Francis was everywhere when Yogananda visited Assisi in 1936. He saw Jesus, he saw Francis holding hands, walking all through that little village of Assisi, and you feel it there. They do not go away, any of these places, these spots. We came into this church here. This was St. Aloysius. In 1940, this building was built. It's interesting because I met an elderly man who said he used to come to church here, and I said, well, you're older than this building. How could you possibly? And he said, well, no, my grandparents brought me here when it was a wooden structure. And I don't have any documents saying that it was a wooden structure, but the bell tower bell is dated 1902. And he said, yeah, this was a wooden structure. It was just like this, he said, the shape. There was no extension. There was a wooden bell tower. It was torn down and rebuilt in 1940. And even after the Monsignor, or the Catholic Church, came in to desanctify this room, because we had purchased it and they had sold it, it didn't work. Because as soon as we came in here, and we had the key to get in early, we came through the front doors, you could feel devotion. Now, whether it's 60 years of devotion or whether it's 100 years of devotion, but immediately you can sense it. And everybody could feel it. And it doesn't matter if you're a long-time meditator or a short-time meditator, you can feel it. When Swamiji years ago was in Spain just on holiday, a couple of the friends who were with him told me that he used to go to a church in this little village and meditate in the morning. And someone asked him, well, is there anything special about the church? And he goes, no, but it's feeling the people's devotion. So you really have a sense of it, just quality. So whether it's somebody having a cosmic experience or whether it's just the fact that it's a gathering like this where people are coming in here to worship and meditate, you can really feel the quality, the sensation of it, the devotion of it. And I also realized in Assisi, when we were in Assisi, that, you know, I came back to the States from there, and I was in Europe, and I was in India for almost 6 weeks. When I came back here, I still had that real sense of inner quality to that joy I was feeling. Then I began to think, is it really the buildings or the temples that are doing it, that is causing it? It is great to be in a place where a saint has been. There's nothing like it. It just makes everything line up inside of you, and you feel so right about yourself. And it feels very natural. There's nothing unusual about it at all. But I began to realize that it's really inside of all of us. It was inside of me. And it just woke up a little bit to be in these places. So the inner path, this tree of life, is the inner pilgrimage that we take through meditation. We've already started it this morning. We did 5 minutes of meditation. That's the start of it. Whether you have meditation technique or not, you already started. So if you don't have an opportunity to travel, and you don't have an opportunity to go to some of the sacred places around the world, I remember being in Sedona. There's churches, and there might be some Buddhist stupas, and there might be some Zendos. But it's not New Age in Sedona. I keep seeing that everywhere in Sedona. New Age, New Age, New Age. It's not. It's Old Age. It's ancient. And you can feel it in the soil that something sacred was there, but multiple thousands of years ago, which is why the Native Americans probably were drawn to it. So when you meditate in temples or you meditate in shrines where saints have lived, it's a great thing to do, but also Mother Earth has a number of places where it's great to meditate, and Sedona is one of them. It's a very powerful magnet for deep, deep, deep stillness in your meditation. Now, the real pilgrimage, though, as I was saying, is the inner pilgrimage. That's the journey that we have to start. We started it today and continue the journey because we can do this right now. Yogananda said that this is the temple. Our body is the real temple. This is the altar, the heart. And this is where we focus in front of the altar to magnetize that energy to this point. And it's not fluky. It's actually very real. And it's very real when you begin your journey. It doesn't matter if sometimes it gets pulled to the left or the right, or you've stepped back a little bit. You just have to keep persevering. If you have to step back, take a time out, as they say in the Living Wisdom School. You need a time out. It's okay to take a time out. But then pick yourself back up and continue your inner journey. Don't let anything out here distract you from it. So whether you meditate 90 minutes, whether you meditate 180 minutes a day, whether you meditate 5 minutes a day, be consistent and be intense when you meditate. Really dive into that 5 minutes or 10 minutes where nothing distracts you. That's the start. That's the start of the inner pilgrimage. And it can happen 24/7. You don't have to go anywhere. You just have to go with your body. Yoganandaji said, we're duals. We're duals of this planet. The sun that's shining today so brightly is this point, the spiritual eye. The universe we see at night. If you get up out of the city lights and you look up at the galaxy, what's the dual? The dual is inside of us. And Yoganandaji said it's much more vast inside of us than out here. So just think about that. What a journey this is, the inner pilgrimage, this tree of life. Dive into it. Just begin the step, one step at a time. You begin to see that it's so real that this becomes just something you're living in. You have to live in it. You have to participate. But it doesn't have to grab you and shake you up like a milkshake and then spit you out. It doesn't have to be that way. The inner journey is the real journey. The inner pilgrimage is the real pilgrimage. Begin it today. Don't let anything stop you, just a little bit. But then just increase it to feel that inner joy and to feel that current. You really do feel it. It is so real, and it's so real every day of our lives.